Is that the mic there?
No, that's the mic, right?
I was going to say that... What the hell was I going to... Yeah, after I wrote the Atramona stories, that was my first... I'd written a fiction story after I got out of high school, and I wanted to be a journalist.
Uh-huh.
And I joined an exchange program, Canada World Youth, and in the Canadian half, and it's with a third world country, I went to Indonesia. In the Canadian half, I worked at a newspaper in Alberta, St. Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't like the experience. I didn't like the constraints mm-hmm. of writing facts.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was in Indonesia, I was lying on a beach one day, and I just started writing a story.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote a novella.
Mm-hmm.
Still to this day, my favorite piece of writing that I've ever done. It'll never be published, because it's mm-hmm. basically about the sexual fantasies of a 13-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, I came back home, and my mom was going to this workshop that Maria Campbell is holding, and she said, I better come.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought I'd come along and just sort of hang around and watch. But Maria,
mm-hmm.
of course, you got to write.
Oh, yeah.
So I wrote three stories, and after that, they're going to get published, and I found out that my three stories would all be published, whereas everybody else only had one. I thought,
mm-hmm.
the eagle rose, and I thought I'd write a novel. And I started writing a novel, and I wrote and I wrote and I wrote for about 3 years. And it was, I shelved it, I put it on the shelf, I just said,
mm-hmm.
it's... I didn't like, I was sick of it. It wasn't doing what I wanted it to. And I didn't write for about 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working at a bar just down the street here.
Mm-hmm.
As a door person and mm-hmm. a front desk. And I just started writing a story. No expectations. It's going to be a novel. It's going to be this mm-hmm. or that. I just started to write a story. I thought maybe 25 pages long. And I wrote and I wrote it and I wrote it. And it ended up about 65 pages long. And I liked it. I called it Hearst and Snow. It's about two brothers. Their father dies. And one's been living in Vancouver. One's been living on the reserve looking after their father. And there's a sister. And they come back for the funeral. And the two brothers don't get along.
Mm-hmm.
And it's based on when my grandfather died. And it was the first time in my life when I saw all my aunts and uncles at one place at the same time. And the four aunts had always been feuding, and they were sitting down at a table with a few of us cousins there, and they were talking about family unity and what's happening, and it's a shame that the family's disintegrating. We told them, bullshit, it's you guys that are fucking it up.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of based on that whole experience.
Yeah.
And the way my grandfather's funeral worked, there was a ceremony in the city, then we took his body out to the reserve for a wake for a funeral. So that's what the story is like that. There's a ceremony in the city, and then the two brothers are in the hearse, and they're taking the body to the reserve, and there's a blizzard, and they get stuck in the hearse, in the back of the hearse with their father overnight. And that's sort of where the crux of the story happens. It's where they have to come to terms with their That's one of the novellas. I finished it. I took it to Pemmican, and at that time, Beatrice Culleton was managing.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. She wrote April Raintree, which
mm-hmm.
she's the fourth person who's mm-hmm. really done mm-hmm. a lot.
I was going to say that with the two brothers, there's a parallel with the two sisters.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I took it to her because she'd written a book called Spirit of the White Bison.
Oh yeah.
Which got heavily criticized, but I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, it's sort of that length. And she said she couldn't publish it on its own. Maybe
mm-hmm.
I could make it longer. And I thought, well, the story's finished. That's mm-hmm. where it begins. That's where it ends. I said, I'll write two more. She said, sure, okay. When you'll have them finished by? Oh, a couple of months, no problem. It took two more years. But then I wrote the next story, and it was a bit different. The two brothers, again, all three stories have two brothers as a central character. The book's mm-hmm. called Brothers in Arms. But the second story was one brother this was set a few years in the future, maybe in the late 90s, where the optimism that I have about economic linking of reserves and the communication, the satellite for Native Communication mm-hmm. Society and the Native network and all that's in place, computer linkages and
mm-hmm.
A Native-owned transportation
mm-hmm.
network.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the brothers is a journalist working at a native multimedia.
Mm-hmm.
And the other brother is a terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
They're both older, and the one brother is older than the other.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in Wounded Knee, and they're both in the days of, you know, the occupation mm-hmm. of Anishinaabe mm-hmm. Park in Kenora, which my sister was at,
mm-hmm.
and all this stuff. And it's a revival of Red Power. And I started writing this about a year and a half ago before the E12 issue ever came up.
Yeah.
And this rallying now that's starting to begin to happen. And the one, the brother that is a terrorist, he's with a group. They've blown up a church and a brewery down east. And in Winnipeg, they've blown up the Hudson's Bay Company. And, you know, the three oppress, you know, the major mm-hmm. oppressors.
Sure.
And the one brother's, you know, figuring, putting two together. Hey, this might be a native group. He gets on the chase, you know, let's mm-hmm. dig the story.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
And it's his brother. He doesn't know it's his brother. So there's a whole... the detective side of it, and,
mm-hmm.
and their mother, the older brother, would, when they went to Anishinaabe Park in Kenora, in all fiction, his mother, I wrote down, had been raped and killed by an RCMP officer. And I have a scene in there when, while she's being raped, she reaches for his gun to pull the gun out of the holster, and she
mm-hmm.
can't.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I put that in there is because J.J. Harper,
mm-hmm.
the cop, says he reached for his gun and pulled
mm-hmm.
it out. But she was killed. He didn't tell his little brother. But the cop that killed his mother was an RCMP officer who was doing it during the summer, and during the rest of the year he was going to law school. He later went into politics, and at the time that the story is set, he's now the Minister of Indian and Northern Affairs.
Sounds like Janklow, South Dakota.
Oh yeah? Yeah, here's
Governor
things.
Of South Dakota.
I hear
he
stories.
An Indian girl when he
oh,
was
really?
An advisor on... I think on Pine Ridge, he was
really?
A legal advisor, he's a lawman. And during the height sort of AIM activities, he said there's one solution for the American Indian movement, that's a bullet through the heads of Dennis Banks and Russell Means. That's why Dennis Banks jumped bail.
Hmm.
He fled because he knew if he was going back to South Dakota, that's it.
Yeah.
But later on, he did care about
himself. He did, so...
Yeah. He served his sentence after Janklow wasn't around anymore.
Wow.
But he was on political sanctuary
yeah, he
in California. And then
New York.
The Iroquois. But that was in California, was 5 or 6 years. He was chancellor of DPU. I was teaching there, and he was chancellor.
Wow. That's funny because the guy who edited my book said, I don't think this is really believable.
It is.
And
There is a case like
wow.
that. That's William Janklow, ex-governor of South Dakota. It's documented. The
wow.
tribal court. At Pine Ridge, no, it's Rosebud, I think, but Rosebud Tribal Court. They treated this and all the law stuff. They wanted him to appear. Of course, he didn't appear.
Right.
But he's been
That's
sentenced.
Funny. There's a guy who's doing time, serving a sentence for life in Sioux Falls. And when he first committed the murder, alleged, he was convicted very easily. And at that time, the governor's son had also murdered somebody and got off scot-free. But he told me once that he thought Janklow was pretty straight kind of guy. He doesn't like Indians, and he admits it. That's what he said about him.
Yeah, I wouldn't call that a straight kind of guy. Okay.
But another aspect of the story, too, that, like, I thought of native terrorism. This was a couple of years ago again, but I was talking to one of the writers that I'll be meeting tonight. She knows people in Ontario, native people, who are serving time for
mm-hmm.
blowing up
yeah.
Pickering. They set a bomb at the Pickering
mm-hmm.
nuclear station. Why Pickering, I don't know, but
mm-hmm.
that's already happened. So
mm-hmm.
as all these facts are coming, I'm going, hey, wow, it fits the story.
Right.
So the crux of the story happens when the brother Cesus breaks in and shoots everybody except for a Cesus plant who was in the group.
Oh, yeah.
And the older brother gets away and goes back to his brother's place while the news flashes over the air and his editors call him to get his butt down to, you know, so-and-so to cover the story. And his brother finally tells him the story about his mother. Or his yeah. And then he goes off to Indian Affairs loaded with dynamite to
mm-hmm.
meet up with the minister. And his brother is later on in the day taken down there by CSIS and the RCMP to talk him out of it. That's what that story is about. And the third story is two brothers again. They've been apart for a long time. One of them is dying of AIDS, and he wants to die in the reserve. And he phones up his brother, tells him this, and wants him to help out. He wants to fix up the house that they spent time in when they were really young, before their father died, before their mother was committed to an asylum because she lost her sanity. And it's a struggle, his own personal struggle, although I don't dwell on it, but his own homophobia, the one brother, and then with his other brother against the reserve and their homophobia. And a bit of the physical and emotional things that an AIDS victim goes through as they're dying. And for that one, I interviewed a guy who's gay, and a close personal friend of his had died of AIDS. And that's a lot of the stuff that he went through are based on, I wrote about.
And that was a native guy.
Yeah.
And he had the same kind of problems on the reserve that you described.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
More dramatically than maybe the book. He went home, he was from the Paw. His name's Paul P. And he went home to the reserve, and nobody accepted him. A, because he's gay, nobody else knew he had AIDS except his mother. And his mother turned him away. And he was dying in the hospital. He was in St. Boniface Hospital. At this point, at this point, he knew he wasn't leaving the hospital anymore. This was it. And shortly before he died, his mother came down and sat with him and accepted him. And that's what he died with. Yeah. So that's in the book too. That's in the story. The first one, Hearst and Snow, I dedicated each one in memory of, is in memory of my grandfather. The third one is in memory of Paul P. And the second one, the Red Waves with the terrorists, and that is, I dedicated it to, or in memory of Buddy Wolf and Adam Aquash and all the others. So that's what the book's
about. I've got some books out that are dedicated to new people.
Yeah?
Yeah. Dedicated to Raymond LeBou, who was the spokesperson of the Pig River people in California. They got rid of all the land, and they squat every once in a while on tribal territory, because they never signed a treaty, So it's still their land, and the government knows it, so they get arrested for loitering, all kinds of stuff, but never raising the issue of who owns the land.
It was like that in
BC. He was fighting until I met him before he died. Yeah, he's really ill, and it's also dedicated to he was a black activist in Guyana, Walter Rodney. He also wrote a book about how Europe underdeveloped Africa. He was a good man. He was blown to pieces by secret police. He was going up for his trial, and he would be acquitted, and he turned the ignition and the whole thing blew up. So that was one book. Another one I dedicated to three people who are living in the past.
There's so many people that have been killed. There's so many people that have been killed.
Have you read Slash?
No.
I think that's a nice book.
Who
there
wrote
you
that?
See Janet Armstrong. Oh, this novel, Slash. Came out by Fetus. That's a wonderful book.
I've heard
brings
about
up last sort of 20 years of movement scenes through one character, but there are all kinds of characters coming in, so it's a whole mosaic. It's a wonderful thing.
I heard about it, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'm talking again.
I don't read as much as I should, but one book I'm reading now is written by Jeffrey Goodman, American Genesis. He's an archaeologist, PhD, who's...
I think I heard about that book.
...suggesting that the Bering Strait theory is real, but the migration was modern man developing in North America and going the other way.
Right.
Yeah.
That's something that
and his whole
years
theory,
and years ago, Floyd Westerman told a German audience. He said, the archaeologists find our tracks on the Bering Strait. And each time they find them... they're getting older and older. One time you people will have to acknowledge we went across backwards.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's coming that way.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely.
It's, I think his whole theory was dependent upon a new dating technique
mm-hmm.
that tested the polarization of amino acid crystals.
Yeah, the radiocarbon.
Beyond radiocarbon.
Oh, beyond that.
Yeah, radiocarbon, I think, only goes back, is only accurate to 40,000 years ago.
Oh, I see.
And there's digs in North America that that's as
How
far
old?
As...
I
yeah. It's suggested one dig was like 500,000. There's others. There's one in the northern Yukon, which, mm-hmm. believe it or not, was never dug up by glaciation. It was untouched. And there's, I think it was the Old Crow dig. Mm-hmm. Goes back to 140. But it's all, his whole theory is dependent upon the archaeological community accepting this new dating technique.
You know what intrigued me? For years and years I worked on, and I still do, on Indian stereotyping, and I published on that, trying to sort of decolonize our own minds, I mean, white minds, because we're raising all these myths to protect us against the truth. No? Okay, anyway, what intrigued me was about the Bering Straits theory. Why, to begin with, did Europeans have to show that what was here came from somewhere else? If it came from Eurasia, maybe there was a chance it came from Europe, or is that the reason? I don't know.
I think
it's weird.
I've always felt that it's because it justifies them colonizing and
saying this they is also our... so came and so
yeah,
did they. Okay. Well, I heard that from. Yeah.
I don't know. The conquest.
That's pretty stupid.
Justifying the conquest.
Yeah, yeah. There is no justification.
No, the Spanish, or who were they, missionaries or whatever, they burnt all the Mayan libraries.
And the Inca too.
And they had mathematical systems that would
far
advance than what we have today.
It's the only one, I think, that can really handle a leap year without adding an extra day. I don't know how they do it, but they have a calendar that is far more advanced. There's a wonderful little book about things like that, also put out by Thetis. I forgot the author, but it's called Indian Giver.
Oh, yeah?
It was actually originally written by a white person in respect of what native cultures have given the world, and just lists them, you know,
mm-hmm.
in medicine, in astrology. And one thing that I find is very important, and I talk about that a lot, is foodstuffs. The four staple foods of the world, two of them are native, potatoes and corn, right?
Mm-hmm.
And most people have in Europe don't know that. I think potatoes, oh, they've always
come from Ireland.
Well, they probably think came from...
Plus is wild rice.
Yeah, sure. So, there's a lot.
There's so much...
It's always displaced, that knowledge.
Yeah.
For obvious reasons. So you don't feel guilty. We don't feel guilty.
But people... Like, there's still the whole colonial attitude that Native people suffer from. You know, we've been colonialized so much that a lot of Native people disinherit the past. Let's not harp on negative. Let's not harp on... Everybody's oppressed. But my feeling is that it can't be overstated. So much has been ripped off and destroyed and polluted. It can't be overstated, and the injustice is so immense. And there's so much. I'm sure that it's still alive, but the time isn't right. I don't know when or how, but I do believe that the philosophy of Native people is going to become a universal thing.
Yeah.
And
it has to.
Yeah.
If we are to survive on this planet. I see.
In conjunction with the philosophy of all Aboriginal people, you know, all land-based people.
Yeah.
there's so much of the richness of the culture and the medicine that I hope can survive.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if a lot of it, I don't, the optimist in me feels that we haven't lost it, that it is still there. People have it, they're not, for obvious reasons, and not
mm-hmm.
sharing it.
Mm-hmm.
But I my feeling is the time is to begin to. I think that more people like yourself are willing to, not so much, you know,
what's the word?
Not admit, but to share and realize and understand and
mm-hmm.
have, not sympathy, but a lot of empathy.
I think if we manage to, if I say we, I mean mainly non-native people.
Mm-hmm.
If we manage to get across just respect of human beings, of creation,
right.
that would be enough. But we're not brought up that way to respect others.
I know, it's such a struggle to attain that
mm-hmm.
state of mind. But I think there's a lot of, it's growing the number of people.
Mm-hmm. I think so too.
It's not the people in power, and that's
the
problem.
No, sure. It's always the poor people.
Yeah.
And the outsiders, the underdogs. That's true.
The people between the cracks.
That's right. Or the borderline.
Yeah.
That's, and you mentioned that, sort of living in the borderlands, or on a fence or whatever. That's a concept that you also find amongst other people, like Chicanas. Chicanas write about that, living in the borderlands. That's both the borderlands, the U.S.-Mexican border, but it's also the cultural borderlands, the borderlands of gender. There's one writer, Gloria Anzaldúa, who's lesbian. She writes about her personal borderlands. And there are others who write about this. Some black writers call it meridianism, like Alice Walker's Meridian. It's a life that does not admit being categorized from the outside. You're this or that or that. Or if you're not, you're happy, you're empty as part of that or so. But being a person sharing in a world that is to come and that people are struggling for. And say, the borderlands, I've got the options. There's something positive, not a neither nor. There are even evolved theories called liminality. Limes is the border in Latin. And liminality, the possibility of relating to various sides or halves or so, but still remain a whole person and not be categorized and reject outside classification. So when you said this, I said borderlands because I had that in mind, maybe I should say that. And it's the borderlands people who are more perceptive.
Awareness.
Yeah.
And acceptance. But it's not something we learn, it's something that we have to evolve intellectually at this point. It's not something that's, I know, maybe if you, you know, if a child grows up in a vacuum, it might be natural, I don't know. But the people, and for myself, that it's something that you have to evolve in your own,
mm-hmm.
develop in your own mind. And often it's just the luck of the draw about who your parents are and who you come in contact with as you grow up. Because the heartland of North America is generally a bigoted wrestling fan type society. And they're really scary. Like this whole, you know, Aboriginal Justice Inquiry thing happening here. It's bringing a lot of the biggest out of the closet.
That's
it's bringing
right
a lot
here,
of.
Right?
Yeah.
You know that in Maria Campbell's book, the large section that she had on the RCMP was never published. Did she ever tell you that? She also said that on a writer's conference, but I asked her about that again. That book originally, the manuscript for Hartford, was about 2,000 handwritten pages.
Ooh,
and the publishers then cut that down
right.
and said, you can't publish that, and she's very happy about that. She got the proofs, and there was a large section on RCMP. And she also proofread those proofs. But when the book came out, they were omitted.
Hmm.
So she says one day she'll sit down and write that again and get that published. But who knows whether she'll ever have the time.
She talked to me, and well, she talked to a lot of us about the climate when she wrote that book. She said, it was a successful book. I think it still has a record as the best-selling first book by anybody in Canadian history. But the publisher, it was at a time when Native nationalism was rising and, you know, that was becoming a more of a forefront issue in society, and people are interested. There's, you know, I have to bring my heart on one knee and all that. And so there's a right climate for a book like that. And she didn't have a lot of to say. The publisher told her how to dress, what to say at the press conferences, what to do. And she knew that she couldn't, you know, she couldn't rock the boat at that time. She just went along. But I think now with places like Thetis and Pemmican, and we have greater control over.
I mean, even a publishing house like Fifth House is putting out good stuff. They're non-natives, but I went up there and talked to them.
What's your name?
They have it all together. On the one hand, they've got, I think, a certain amount of dedication, but they're also very, very smart as business people about it.
Yeah.
For example, the editor, I forgot his name, he went around bookstores and asked people, what are the native authors that people ask for and they're out of print? And they said, okay, this book or that book. So they're now republishing Howard Adams' Prison of Grass. Do you know that? He's a half-breed. He says half-breed. He's also from Saskatchewan. He's a good friend of mine.
There's so many native books that you can't get a hold of anymore.
That's right, because they're in limited small editions.
Yeah, you know, like that American Genesis one, with that theory about it's...
Yeah.
I can't remember the term the bookstore gave me, but apparently, you know, the publishers sold off all the remaining copies they had to one company to do with what they wanted, and it's, you can't get it anymore.
Oh, yeah.
And another one, The Life and Times of Anna May Aquash.
It's not out of print, huh?
I don't know if it's out of print.
I
can't
heard
find
about it.
It,
but I never got a hold of it.
Yeah. She's in town.
The author?
Johanna Brandt, yeah.
Is she from Six Nations?
She's white. She's in town. Her husband is Ed Reed, who used to work at CBC. Johanna Brandt.
Sounds German.
Ed Reed. You might be able to find Ed Reed. He used to work for Information Radio at the CBC. Actually, one time he was producing my mom's radio program, Our Native Land. And she was still there.
Ed Reed.
She wrote The Life and Times of Anna May Aquash.
Mm-hmm.
I also have aspirations as a filmmaker. Right now I'm writing a half-hour drama for the CBC. It's based on the first story in the book that I'm writing.
Oh, yeah.
But I'd love at some point to do a film on Anna May Aquash. Something like the Silkwood type film, or that one about the coup in Chile where the American was killed after he found out too much information. It's just his basic, something of that genre, what Anna May Aquash, but I'd have to do that years down the road.
You know, in Slash, that novel by Janet Armstrong, there's a character that I thought immediately that's Anna May Aquash.
Yeah.
And I asked her, she said, well, she didn't, there were several cases, she didn't really have her in mind, she's been asked this again and again. It's probably like you, writing about stuff that does happen, and then later on you find, there's a specific case. Because the structures that you, the political structures and ideological structures or whatever that you write about are the same that surround you. So even if you dream up a case, there's bound to be something very similar. Because you have a clear perception of what the structures are, I guess.
I'm really excited about Native writers, because it's historically it's always been the artists of any people that have made change. Mm-hmm. They've always been the persecuted ones and the ones who are always broke. But they've always been, not trying to give us more due than we should have, but it's not going to be the native politicians that do anything for us.
I'm
sure you've heard stories.
Politicians only work for themselves.
The bureaucracy serves the bureaucracy.
In all societies, I mean.
I know some nice guys that are chasing all that, but then, you know, they have, their vision only reaches this far.
Mm-hmm.
They're too safe now. Like, 20 years ago, it was different. Guys like Dave Cushane Sr. and George Manuel, when they went to Ottawa, they'd take the cheap train fare, the, you know, Indian Affairs.
Now they do it differently.
And, you know, sleeping in people's living rooms. Now it's, well, I can't get a hotel room, I can't go to Ottawa. There's a different, there's a total different level of commitment now.
During this whole trip, I was once put up in a I think, expensive hotel.
Yeah.
That was right here by the Native Stores Department. As if they were about all that much money. I didn't say no.
Yeah.
I said, actually, I suggested going to a cheaper one. No, no, you have this, that's a fine hotel. Sure, it's a fine hotel.
Place Real?
Huh?
Where?
That's the Ramada Inn.
Oh, yeah, okay.
It's far more expensive than the places I've been to before.
You should go to the Regis. That's where all the Indian people go.
Yeah, I saw that. I was in the breakfast room there. I was together with another scholar from Germany for 1 week, and we rented a car in Regina, went up to Saskatoon and Tosh and St. Louis, that's where Howard Adams comes from, small community, and then Prince Albert, and then we drove back to Neepawa in Manitoba.
Neepawa is where Margaret Lawrence
exactly, yeah, because of that, and then to Hayland. It doesn't exist anymore. That's where this novel by Martha Austin, So Wild Geese, came out. It's located there. I read an article about that. So I want to check that out. So I just went there and to Gimli, because that's where Laura Goodman Salverson sort of, and then came here. And we stayed one night in a, we always shared rooms to make that, and the car seat was much cheaper that way. And we stayed one night at Hotel 49 or something, or 75 or something. It was okay. And then the next day he was staying two more days, and I took the car back to Regina. This was Monday, I think. And so I put him up, or we put him up at the St. Regis. That's nice.
We call it the Embassy.
Mm-hmm. Is there a Department of Indian and Native Northern Affairs somewhere near?
I saw so many.
You know, that's what I told him. He said, oh, there's so many Indians. I said, yeah, there must be the DINA must, DINA must be somewhere close, because
you know that glass
a lot of them are executives or people in Indian business, Indian politics. So
there's there's a lot around there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's what I thought.
Actually, the night J.J. Harper got killed, he started out at the St. Regis. And you, like, this is...
You tell me about that.
In my party days, this is the same route I'd take. After work, you go to the St. Regis Hotel for a few beer, then you meet some friends. You always meet somebody, you know.
Yeah, sure.
Then you go from there to the Westbrook. And at that time, they came out with a new bar called DJ's. It used to be you'd go from there to the Club Morocco. Close down the evening, but he went to DJ's with friends, and he left DJ's just before closing time and was walking down Logan Avenue towards his house. And there's a stolen car. The police were on a trail of two young Native people that stole a car. There's a description. The description was shorter and lighter than J.J. Harper. And what the policeman says is that he saw Harper walking down the street. The only reason he stopped him was because he was Native.
Sure.
And he came up to him, said he tried to talk to him. And then Harper turned around and was aggressive, went for his gun, pulled it out of the holster. And they struggled with the gun, and the gun went off, and it hit Harper in the chest.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know the exact physical description of the struggle, but one of the columnists from the Winnipeg Free Press tried to recreate it, and he said it would take an acrobatical. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody from China might be able to do this. But the guy died, and the police launched an inquest into the death, an internal investigation which lasted 2 days or something like that, and they exonerated the officer, no wrongdoing at all. Like that. But that death sparked outcries, and at the same time there was the murder of Helen Betty Osborne and the PAW that happened in 1971. Nobody was ever convicted of it until last year. They convicted one of the four youth at that time. Now they're middle-aged men. He's serving time for second-degree murder. But it took 15 years for that to come forward. So those two incidences sparked this Aboriginal Justice Inquiry. And it happened at a time when, the Donald Marshall case was happening off Nova Scotia. And the whole policy of the Winnipeg Police Department came under scrutiny.
Is that where one of the officers are in charge of the inquest?
One of the officers in charge of the investigation into the Harper shooting. And he was also in charge of another... a cab driver got killed about 2 years ago. And he was in charge of that investigation too. This guy's had 19 or 17 years on the police force. And he was in charge of that investigation. And at one point, he had charged... Two Native men were charged, and he had a Native woman as a witness to this slaying or whatever. And under cross-examination, she broke down and said the police had forced her to lie. So now they got somebody else up on that charge, but he was in charge of that investigation. And the morning that he was to testify before the inquiry, he killed himself.
Copped out, huh?
Yeah, the chief of police, the mayor, and the chief of police said basically that the stress created by the Aboriginal Justice Inquiry led to a suicide. The man who shot...
Who's got the blame?
Huh? Yeah, the man who shot J.J. Harper, the Police Officers Association and the police department and the city fought and fought and fought. They've been trying all along to get it, to undermine the inquiry. At one point they said, well, it's not infringed too, it's unconstitutional. That got thrown out of court. But this guy, they said, he was under psychiatric care. He's not stable enough. He's suicidal. He won't be able to handle the stress of testifying. They didn't want him to testify. The guy that shot Harper, the inquiry judges said, well, he's got to testify. So he did. But he didn't say anything new. But one of the policemen who was at the scene that night broke down on the stand and admitted that he'd rewritten his notes that he'd taken that night.
So are the judge or the people examining, are they pretty good?
Yeah, one of them is a Native guy. There's lawyers for the inquiry.
Yeah.
There's lawyers for the Adam Lake Tribal Council where J.J. Harper worked, and there's a lawyer for the Harper family.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard good and bad things about what they're trying to do.
Can you go to that?
You can go.
Do you ever go?
No. It's on TV, though. Like, they broadcast it live on the video special programming.
I watch it on TV a lot. Maybe I should. But then I can't read.
Well, I do have every 2 weeks I do a show on the Community Access Channel here on Native issues. You're going to write
that down.
It's sponsored by the Winnipeg Council of Treaty and Status Indians.
Mm-hmm. That's at 7 in the evening?
Yeah. It's supposed to be on tomorrow night, but I had a guest on who I didn't find out until after the show that I couldn't have on because he's running for re-election in the civic elections here.
Oh.
So it won't be on tomorrow night. But his name is Terry Wozniak, and he's running for a core area.
Write your next novel with him.
But he said he made a presentation at the inquiry, and he came out and admitted that obviously there's a cover-up. And I've talked to other friends of mine who aren't Native, and they said, obviously the guy panicked and shot him. Why didn't they just come clean?
Yeah. No, maybe it's good it's going that way, because they're wallowing so much in the mud, there's much more stink that's going to come up.
Right now, the head of the police association had called for the chief's resignation. He later denied that accusation, but they had it on tape, so they couldn't... But is that? No, he said that the chief's lost all the men have lost confidence in the chief. There's total morale, lack of morale. The mayor came out and said, "Well, yeah, you know, the justice inquiry must, you know, that led to his suicide. Let's wind it up as quickly as possible." And it's a provincial inquiry, so the provincial government, the justice minister in Manitoba said, "Well, we should wind it up as quickly as we can too." And now they've delayed any more hearings on the justice inquiry until the inquest into the death to that officer's suicide is finished, because there's two suicide notes he left. And the chief of police said in the suicide notes he alluded to the Aboriginal Justice Inquiry as one of the causes of his suicide, but he never released them. And the coroner's inquest into his suicide, they said they're not going to release that suicide note until they're finished their inquest, and he figures it'll go on for about a month. So the justice inquiry is going to wait until that's all done before it resumes. But there's so much, like, a lot of new people made presentations, and it's nothing that I haven't heard before. The accusations sort of put a burr up the rear end of the city and the RCMP about treatment. Because I, relatives, my cousin, when he was living in Winnipeg, what, 10 years ago, he got taken out to a seldom used road in the northern city, and they beat the crap out of him and left him there. My mom's ex-husband once was at a bar on Main Street. He had $800 in his pocket. The police picked him up, beat him up, dropped him off at Main Street Project, and when he woke up, the $800 was gone. And there's so much of that that is always happening. And, you know, we know about it. And it took something like this to bring that out. And still people, you know, half, I think, listen to radio talk shows and public feedback, it's about 50-50. Yes, we should go on, you know, we're hearing things that we should hear, we have to deal with this, and the other 50% are going, there's no basis for this, and they're just a bunch of this and that.
They don't want their mothers, yeah.
We should go. Yeah.